This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Jennifer Adams, a passionate av geek who works in the accounting and finance department of a mid-sized airport. We cover a lot of territory, including Aviation Day with American Airlines, how the airport and her job have changed, working the de-icing pad, and airport outreach. Oh, and airport stairs trucks. In the news, we discuss airport scanning tech, facial recognition technology, and carry-on screening, as well as airport vehicle traffic and the challenges presented by the growth in ride-sharing services. Also, Norwegian wet leases and A380 to cover for 787 engine problems, and Southwest issues a policy for trained service animals that has us shaking our heads. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 517 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first another Max. He's Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a 2008 CFI of the Year, expert on learning to fly and purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max, how are you?
I am awesome. Great to be here for a couple of weeks in a row. I'm trying to regain my status as a regular host here. I don't want you to throw me out.
Don't worry. No danger of that. Okay. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our resident aviation historian and military aviation expert. He blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hello, everybody. Looking forward to another show with my best geek friend.
Of course, that's our guest this episode. It's Jennifer Adams. She's a returning guest, and she combines her experience in accounting with her passion for aviation. Does that by working in the accounting and finance department of a mid-sized Midwestern airport. Now, when she's not paying the bills, when she's not sending invoices to airlines, you can find her helping out on the de-ice pad, plane spotting, in getting somewhat pathologically excited about stairs trucks for some reason. It's true.
Yeah, it is true.
Jennifer also blogs about her aviation adventures at talesfromtheterminal.com. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Max, David, Max. Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here.
Now, I heard a rumor about getting a green jacket if you're on the show multiple times.
Well, yeah, that requires five or more there, dear.
Okay, good. No, I wanted to know what the parameters were so I could make sure I was keeping track.
Yeah, we send those along with the paycheck.
Oh, great.
All right. Well, we're going to talk to Jennifer about a couple of things, airports as always, but also, Jennifer, you were just at an event this past weekend that was part of the National Aviation Day celebration, weren't you? You were in Philadelphia, I think.
Indeed, I was. I was in David Vanderhoof territory. Yes, it's with the airlinegeeks.com and American Airlines, and they allow a limited number of people to go behind the scenes at each of their hubs. I believe David participated in Philadelphia a couple of years ago. I did Charlotte last year, but this year I was really excited to be able to check everything out there in Philadelphia. So that was a really great time.
Cool. We're going to talk about that. I think this was the third year maybe that they've done this.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in some detail, but first, we're going to talk about some aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
You
ready
bet.
From the West.
Ready.
First item comes from marketplace.org. This is facial scan technology makes debut in airports. We see that Orlando International Airport, they're using facial recognition technology for all arriving and departing international travelers. Now, this is a program. It comes from a partnership with U.S. Customs and Border Protection and CITA, S-I-T-A. It's a private cybersecurity company. And what happens is passengers stand on a yellow footprint. A camera takes a picture that's matched against the CBP passport photo database. And if there's a match, then the identity's confirmed. If there's not a match, well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they haul you off or something, a different part of the process.
It's a bad hair day, obviously, if you don't match.
Yes, yes. So I think this is kind of fascinating. There's different motivations for this, I think. There's maybe an obvious security motive here, but also a desire to process passengers more quickly, which would always be a good thing. But there's other issues associated with this as well. I don't know. What's your gut? Jennifer, when you hear about this, what do you feel first off?
Well, am I right in remembering that it's for international passengers only at this point?
Yeah, at this point.
So my first thought is that we won't really be dealing with it at my airport anytime soon. You know, anything that speeds up the security lines is generally a good thing. I do have some questions, though, I would say, about what they're doing with that information, you know, just some privacy concerns, me personally. Since we don't have a lot of international passengers, we have some and we're working on getting more, but I don't see it happening at my airport anytime soon.
Now, of course, we know that the airport itself doesn't operate the security process, right?
That's the TSA.
Right. But if there's an issue with something new, a change like that, where the public might have concerns or thoughts or something, do you still leave it all to the TSA to manage that change, or would an airport possibly get involved as well?
I think the airport's primarily involved in terms of making sure that we have the space for the equipment and that it fits into the flow, whatever that might be. I know that we have in the past undertaken expanding checkpoint areas to be able to fit more people through it more quickly.
Hmm.
And so if there's going to be new equipment and it's going to involve a different flow through the checkpoint system, then the airport would definitely be involved in whatever construction or rearranging would be needed to fit the equipment in there. Now, as for dealing with complaints, if someone picks up the phone and calls the airport and complains, we will definitely listen. But unfortunately, if that is what the TSA is requiring, I don't know that the airport really has any ability to mitigate that on behalf of passengers.
There's a quote in this article. It's from John Newsom, the chief information officer for the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority. And he says there's a congressional mandate that all international passengers be positively identified using biometrics. So this is going to expand into other areas. I see here that 9 other airports in the United States are in the process of testing this technology, including Miami, O'Hare in Chicago, and JFK. Also, overseas, we see the British Airways boarding agent says that facial technology there reduces boarding time to about 25 minutes, whereas it had been around 45 minutes previous to that. So that's a pretty significant reduction. But yeah, there's that sort of nagging privacy issue. I don't know. David, is that something that you would worry about?
Worry about privacy? No, this is the guy that pays attention to the FBI when he monitors his website. Is it any different than all of the security cameras that are scattered throughout a city like London or Philadelphia or New York? What are they doing with the data? How long are they storing the data? Is the data secure? It's all how it's handled post the process.
Mm.
And if it's like going through and having a full body scan, you know, that data is immediately stopped or deleted. So, I mean, facial recognition, Max, you should be able to speak to this. You use it all the time to operate your phone now.
That's right.
It's going to be very commonplace that, you know, it's going to be the next way to identify yourself. You know, Is it any different really than fingerprints? You know, it's just another way to identify yourself and use personal traits, you know. The nice thing about facial recognition is that someone's going to have to work really hard to recreate your face, you know.
Especially this face.
Well, either way, but it's, I mean, it gets kind of creepy. If anybody has seen the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report, then I guess it's about 10 years old now. There's one scene where facial recognition is used to cater the billboards to Tom Cruise as he's walking through a mall. As these billboards scan his eyes, they personalize the data towards him. So, I mean, the facial recognition can get creepy, but it's probably something we're all going to have to get used to.
Hmm. Another point that comes up sometimes is accuracy, because you don't want a lot of false positives, right? And false positives meaning, you know, person gets flagged as not being who they identify themselves as. And there have been some reports in the past about accuracy of facial recognition technology applied to different races and different genders and so forth. But in this case, at least according to this article, the Customs and Border Protection is saying they're seeing 97% accuracy, which that sounds really good to me.
Well, of course, they're matching that against photographs that were taken in pretty similar circumstances, right? They're matching them essentially against passport photographs where you've got some standards. So that's probably at least a good starting point for trying to match data. I think that ties into kind of two stories. One that I read just in the last couple of months about in China, they used camera technology to identify somebody who'd gone into a stadium with 40,000 people who had, you know, he was wanted for something. I can't remember what. And so he was arrested. And I remember at the time thinking, well, that's pretty good. One out of, you know, 40,000 people. Hmm. But I hadn't thought about, you know, how many other people did they arrest the same day as false positives. You know, oh, that's, you know, that's not him. And I was just searching here for stories about China and facial recognition, trying to find that original story. And I ran across another one that said they are looking to be able to match faces against 1.3 billion photos that they have on photo ID cards with a 90% accuracy rate, which means they would only be wrong 130 million times, which, you know, seems like a pretty low accuracy rate. But I also saw that Marriott is trialing face recognition check-in services in China. I believe there may be another company doing that as well, too. And China has just installed cameras at the border with Hong Kong, trying to identify what they call free traders, people who are walking back and forth between the two places to try and sell tax-free goods on the mainland that they've picked up while visiting Hong Kong.
Hmm. Well, sticking with the security theme at the airport here, there's an article in The Economist. A new scanner could speed up airport security. And here again, we see the TSA, in this case, testing a new type of X-ray machine for carry-on bags. And if these tests prove successful, the idea is that you would no longer need to remove things from your carry-on, liquids, electronics, things like that. The idea is this technology would find the explosives inside the bags. And I guess this works kind of like a hospital CT scanner. It produces 3D images. And it's being tested at 15 airports. The TSA is looking to deploy about 40 units around by the end of this year, 2018, and deploy more than 145 by the end of September next year, 2019. I think, is there anybody that would be disappointed with not having to empty out the contents of their carry-on bag? I think this would save a lot of time and aggravation.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is one we definitely would look forward to seeing. But again, I guess my one question as an airport person would be the size of the equipment. Is it going to fit into the spaces that we already have for X-ray machines, or is it bigger, smaller? You know, what's that going to mean for our spaces where we're already moving people through security? Is it going to fit in there, or are we going to have to do more construction to get it to fit in?
Yeah, I haven't seen a photograph of this, but certainly if it's like a hospital CT scanner, those things are enormous.
Right.
Certainly take up a lot more cubic space than what we have now at the security lines for carry-on.
Yeah, but anything that is going to maintain, a good level of security but cut down time stuck in the lines is definitely a good thing. It's good for passengers. It's good for the airlines. It's good for the airport. I don't remember the exact number, but they found something like 14 or 15 guns in carry-on bags at my airport so far this year. From that perspective, just from my own personal safety, the safety of people who are at the airport every day, I think about that. And anything that's going to make it easier to identify those types of things, I'm pretty much all for it.
Yes. Well, it's all about managing flow, I think. And another area at airports where there is flow is out at the curb at arrivals. And we have an item here. This is from the Star Telegram. It's titled, "There's Curbside Chaos at DFW Airport, Thanks in Part to the Surge of Uber and Lyft." And really, the headline says it all here. They point out with the limited curbside space at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport at the arrivals area, plus the increased popularity of these ride-sharing programs. Also, with the length of time some people tend to park and wait for the people they're picking up, it's created a significant problem. There's an interesting statistic in terms of the percentage of traffic at DFW that's identified as being Uber or Lyft vehicles is 23%. So what's the airport doing about it? Well, starting September 8th, 2018, no one can park at curbside unless their passenger is present and ready to get in the car. So if you pull up to pick up somebody and they're not there, you sit there for some short period of time, you're going to get shooed away. But also, DFW is adding 1,200 one-hour parking spots in the parking garages, and they've recently opened a cell phone lot just outside of the north entrance. So you could arrive, you could stop at this lot, call your pickup, the person you're picking up, see if they're there and ready, and when they are, depart for arrivals. So here we see, I don't know if you call it technology changing, but culture changing, the shift to the use of these kind of ride-sharing services, and the airport having to respond to that in order to provide good service.
I would say they are behind the curve. I'm just thinking of four airports I've been to recently, all of which have specifically set up designated areas for rideshare cars to go. So, for example, Las Vegas, which I've been to a couple times in the last year, and Boston, both have areas where Lyft and Uber cars show up. But they go beyond that. They actually have a large number of slots. So you've got, the A row 1 through 10, the B row 1 through 20, whatever. So when your Uber driver shows up, that person just texts you, A21. So poof, you walk out to A21, there's your driver. It works incredibly well.
Yeah.
I think there is probably some type of fee that gets added to the fare that gets paid to the airport to, manage the cost of setting aside, a portion of the garage to do that. Essentially the same setup in Boston, though it's outside. So in the wintertime, that one's probably a little bit more uncomfortable because it's not covered. But San Francisco, I think, just recently set up the same thing in the parking garage. San Jose has designated space outside that's apart from everybody else. So I would say, DFW, you are behind the curve. You got to catch up with these other airports that have figured out much better ways to manage this other than just having drivers show up at the curb.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm also really surprised that you could just park there and wait on your passenger. I don't think that's ever been allowed at my airport. If you're there more than a minute or two, they'll move you along. And we've always, at least we've had a cell phone lot for quite some time. We actually just moved it. It's in a better spot now. And it's some good plane spotting from over there. So I highly recommend people who are coming to pick up loved ones definitely stop there at the cell phone lot before coming on up to the terminal. It, even with managing the flow and with a separate area for the Uber and Lyft and taxis, it still can be chaotic out front. I actually liken getting across all the lanes of traffic to the employee shuttle to playing Frogger. I don't know if you remember the game Frogger. Oh, yeah. You have a little frog that you have to get across the highway. Sometimes that's how I feel. I have to cross four lanes of regular passenger pickup, then another four lanes of Uber, Lyft, and taxis, and then another two lanes of shuttle traffic to get to my shuttle. To be fair, there is actually a tunnel underneath, but it's just faster to cross at the street. So I guess I'm making that choice to play Frogger. But I've noticed that we've actually had to sometimes put security in the second set of lanes to kind of keep the Uber and Lyft traffic moving along, as well as having them in the regular lanes. And yes, they do, Uber and Lyft do pay per pickup, and we have to treat them exactly the same as we treat taxis. So they all pay the same fee. And the impact of Uber and Lyft in particular, it goes beyond just congestion at your pickup areas. You know, it has a bigger impact in terms of parking, for one thing. You know, parking is one of the biggest sources of revenue for most airports. And there's a lot less parking going on these days, and in large part due to the easy access to Uber and Lyft and being able to just hop right in. Why would you need to park your car? It also impacts rental car. And then these in turn have sort of a bigger impact when you're looking, as a lot of airports are, I know we are, our terminal was built in the 50s. It's 60 plus years old. So we're starting to look towards what are we going to do? How are we going to replace it? And as part of the bigger picture, how much parking do we need to prepare for? You know, how much of an impact are Uber and Lyft and other similar services going to have? What about things like self-driving cars? What about things like electric cars? There's a lot to think about. I really have to give a lot of credit to airport planners. They've got to get that crystal ball out and really take a good look.
It's a good illustration of the fact that running an airport, which is running a business, is not just a static proposition. Things change that can have big impacts on how you operate that business, that airport. And yeah, you've got to be on your toes, just like any business would.
Sure.
All right. Well, we've been talking over the past few episodes, I think, about the problems with the Trent 1000 engine on the Boeing 787. And we've been talking about the impacts. I think most recently we talked about the impacts on Rolls-Royce. But we have a nice article in Flight Global, Norwegian to deploy HiFly's A380 as 787 cover. And what we have here is Norwegian is negatively impacted by the engine problem on their 787. So they've been leasing an A380 from HiFly in order to cover their evening London to New York service for several weeks this month as we record this being August. HiFly is a Portuguese wide-body aircraft wet lease firm. They own an all-Airbus fleet. They've been around since, I think, 2005. But, Max, this is was kind of amazing. You know, you have a little problem with an engine, and next thing you know, you're wet leasing an A380.
I thought it was kind of interesting that a low-cost discount airline like Norwegian would have an A380. That's really what caught my attention. It's like, well, this is totally unexpected. I found another article I was just looking at here in the background, and apparently that aircraft comes from – it's a former Singaporean aircraft, Singapore Airlines, and it still has a luxury interior with 12 first-class seats and 60 lay-flat business class seats. But what they point out here is that Norwegian doesn't have – a price category higher than premium economy. So apparently 12 lucky people get a very, very luxurious experience. And here's something kind of surprising. First class flights across the Atlantic in this plane, $614.
Wow.
Compared to the average fare of non-first class of $700 with other airlines. So
sign me up.
Yeah, I know. Norwegian's probably going to be able to fill this plane up if they're able to get the word out. It's just for the month of August. It is a wet lease, so essentially it's kind of a short-term rental, which would include fuel and the crew, as opposed to the kind of long-term lease, which would typically be just for the physical airplane itself. But that makes total sense, because Norwegian is not going to have the time or the crew to train to fly an A380 on short notice like that. So, of course, there's going to be a profit margin built into that for the leasing company, HiFly. So they might not be making any money off of this, but at least it does allow them to backfill for the 787 that's been running across the Atlantic, running into problems. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Want to fly an A380? Do it on the cheap with Norwegian.
Yeah, yeah. I've been looking to find some more information about the sort of the specific problem with the engine, and it's reported a little bit differently in some different places, but sort of the consensus seems to be that it's an issue with the second stage blades of the intermediate pressure compressor. And here's an interesting problem. These blades apparently have a resonant frequency that can be activated under certain conditions. And when that resonant frequency is hit, then the blade starts vibrating, and that causes premature cracking down at the root of the blades. So that's a tough engineering challenge to do. So yeah, I guess we'll be living with frequent inspections and probably the need to replace the blades with something that doesn't exhibit that same resonant frequency, but that will not be inexpensive.
Yeah, I mean, resonances are a problem in just about every discipline of engineering, whether it's the bridge up in Washington State that started swinging to the wind at the resonant frequency and came crashing down in the 1940s to other things as well, too. And I was just trying to imagine, you know, what the variable is there. I was thinking maybe air density, and I'm changing different air densities, then you might be able to get a resonance. Other than that, that's the only thing that comes to mind. I mean, speed, obviously, but I would have thought that you know, that would have been, you know, well characterized over the normal speed operating ranges. So I wouldn't think that's it. Any other thoughts on what changing parameter might, you know, lead to a resonance?
No. I mean, you could probably change it relatively easily with a minor redesign, change the thickness at some point, or the mass distribution along the length of the blade, or something like that. But even if it's relatively simple to redesign a blade that doesn't have that same resonant frequency characteristic, you've got to manufacture them, you've got to get them certified, and then you've got to get them into all the engines out there, presumably. But best case might be that the directive may come out that, you have to replace the blade, at the first heavy overhaul or something, or after so many hours of operation. So, I think it'll be interesting to watch that.
I was just thinking, great analogy would be a tuning fork. You hit one of those things, and they are designed to resonate at a certain, to vibrate at a certain frequency. Imagine having tuning forks in your twin turbine blades. It's like, no, that is not the kind of thing you want inside the engine.
Exactly. No ringing from the blades. All right. Another item. We've been having some fun with this over the course of the last few days. Not that it isn't a serious issue, but just some kind of...
Oh, no, it's not. It's not a serious issue.
Well, all right. So Max surfaced this article. This is from Business Insider. It's Southwest Airlines, get ready for this, is formally allowing miniature horses on its planes as service animals. So I don't think I even read the article. I think I immediately went over to the Southwest page. They have a customers with disabilities page, and under trained service animals, here's what they say. They say, effective for travel beginning September 17, 2018. Southwest is making changes to our existing policies for accommodating customers with disabilities who seek to travel with a fully trained service animal in the cabin. Okay, so far so good. Customers with disabilities seeking to travel with a trained service animal must still provide, this is their word, credible verbal assurance that the animal is a trained service animal. Additionally, note the following changes to our policy. 1. Southwest will only accept the following species of animals in our cabin as trained service animals: dogs, cats, and miniature horses. It can't be. That's what it says. And then they say number 2 is Southwest will accept fully trained psychiatric service animals as trained service animals. Miniature horses? Say it ain't so, Joe.
Yeah. And if you go to the article, which is very short, it says the new policy also includes a list of animals that are not eligible to come on board, which features insects, spiders, rabbits, ferrets, or rodents. You know, I'm just thinking the rabbits or the ferrets, I think I would have put them ahead of the miniature horse in terms of allowing them on board. Well, and you pointed out a couple of things as we were emailing back and forth. Do you want to mention some of the things in the policy that you thought didn't make sense or were contradictory relative to bringing horses on board?
Well, when...
Oh, please pony up that knowledge.
That's... All right. Now you all know what the email exchange was like over the last few days. So... It says that a couple of things that
this will be a bunch of unbridled puns.
An animal can be placed on the aircraft floor or on the customer's lap as long as the animal is no larger than a child under the age of 2. All right. I think a miniature. Well, in the first place, a child under the age of 2, that's, you know, there's some big kids out there and some, you know, little guys, too. So that's kind of a vague thing, if you ask me. But I think a miniature horse is larger than a child of age 2. So you can't put your horse on your lap.
We can agree on that.
Now, it says animals must not extend into the aircraft aisle, occupy an aircraft seat, or encroach upon a neighboring seat, or, and this especially applies to horses, it cannot occupy a tray table.
I missed that one. Yeah. That's good.
So if you can't...
So in other words, what you're saying is you need to shoo them into the seat.
But I don't see where a miniature horse would even fit under these conditions. I mean, I wouldn't want one on the airplane anyway, but...
Well, maybe in first class. I mean, there you might have enough seat pitch to do it. Maybe. But think of, I mean, everybody talks about how, you know, their knees are up against the seat. Well, what this policy has essentially said is that's where the horse is going to go, between your knees and the seat in front of you.
Yeah.
And at that, it's going to have to be pretty small to not have its, you know, head sticking into your neighbor's legs.
Now, I know a bunch of you are right now typing out hate mails to us. Just to be clear, I mean... We don't have anything against service animals or emotional support animals, you know, at all. I think that, personally, I think that airlines should have, you know, very explicit policies that are well thought out because of all the problems that we've had. This one just doesn't seem to be all that well thought out.
Doesn't seem workable. I mean, it just, I can't figure out how it's going to work unless you, you know, leave the horse in the galley or something like that.
I did see a picture somewhere, and you're exactly right. They were sitting in the seats, and the horse was sort of in front of them, between their knees and the back of the seat in front.
That's got to be kind of uncomfortable for the horse.
Yeah. So,
can't you just saddle up the horse?
Oh, geez, David.
So maybe we're missing something here. Maybe miniature horses are much smaller than I imagine.
Yeah, they're not that.
They are pretty small. I mean, there are some dogs, you know, big breeds of dogs that are roughly the same size as miniature horses.
Yeah. Okay. If any of you have a miniature horse that you think would fit in under these conditions, please send us a photo. But here's another thing. Credible verbal assurance that the animal is a trained service animal. Credible verbal. What? How does verbal assurance become credible versus incredible?
I think that boils down to that you better have your paperwork.
Yeah, but it says okay that
I know it. I know,
but that's not verbal. That's not verbal.
I know that's verbal. That's not verbal. But Well, clearly, a seeing eye dog or a assistant dog usually is clearly marked as an assistant dog, and you can take verbal credible knowledge saying, "Yes, this is my dog, seeing eye dog."
And of course, we know, of course, everybody is truthful all the time. Even when they're trying to bring their pets on board.
Well, of course. Why do you think they're coming up with this?
Well,
I want to know who brought the horse aboard. Not who let the dogs out, but who brought the horse aboard.
All right, here we go. We have found the definitive authority on this, which of course would be Wikipedia. And it says that depending on the particular breed involved, a miniature horse is usually less than 34 to 38 inches at the mane. So it's kind of a height-based definition. So basically, take a yardstick, and that's how tall your miniature horse is. I would imagine it's probably longer than that, which is definitely going to be wider than a seat.
It sounds big to me. Now, this one, I know this is a rabbit hole, but as far as booking reservations, here's what the airline says, quote, "We strongly encourage," that's definitive, "we strongly encourage a customer to notify us in advance if he, she will be traveling with a trained service animal." They strongly encourage it. So you show up at the airport with your miniature horse and they say, "Well, we strongly encourage," yeah, okay, but it wasn't a requirement and here I am. This whole thing, I don't know who wrote this. It just doesn't seem like it's practical or well thought out. So
it was a monkey with a typewriter. Oh, I'm sorry. That was Shakespeare that they were going to end up with.
Right. Yeah. 100 monkeys, 100 typewriters, 100 years creating all the books.
That's right.
My guess is the policy is going to have to get modified. I mean, this is probably the first pass, and they'll just find out how it works, and they'll figure out ways to make it work. But boy, on the face of it, it just seems a little odd.
It does.
Does the horse go out first down the slide or after the person?
Oh, my God. I never even thought about that.
Yeah.
I mean, what I had thought about is what kind of egress do you have from the airplane? You know, suppose the person is in the aisle seat with their horse. You know, how do people in the middle seat and the window seat reasonably get out in an emergency?
They say, "Giddy up."
Oh.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to move on.
That was the thing, guys. I've been saving this up for the last couple of days as you guys have been wasting it on emails.
Yeah. All right. So if you have a differing opinion, you know, the geeks at airplanegeeks.com, write to us, record a little message, what your thoughts are, you know, be nice. And if, you know, if we've got our facts wrong or we're not looking at this the right way, please, we do want to hear from you.
Yeah, we're willing to be educated. We certainly don't know the full story on this. It's just on the face of it, it just seems a little odd.
Yep.
And in all fairness, one of my coworkers, I said to her that we were doing a story about horses on airplanes, and she immediately said, "You're joking, right?" That I'm like, "No," and I pulled up the article, and she's like, "Okay, where's Snopes when I need it?" So there's just some unplausible, doesn't belief aspect to this that, you know, I'm all for therapy riding. I'm all for, you know, using horses for therapy, but it's just not something you would expect to hear.
All right. Again, we're speaking with Jennifer Adams. Jennifer blogs at talesfromtheterminal.com. She's, are you in charge of the whole airport yet, Jennifer?
No, I am not, thankfully.
Yeah, that's got to be a tough job, I imagine. But
yes, I do not want that job.
So let's talk about National Aviation Day. Now, that is observed each year in the United States on August 19. And it was actually proposed by President Franklin Roosevelt, or proclaimed by him, I guess I should say, back in 1939. And it coincides with the birthday of Orville Wright, who you've probably heard of before. And this is where I could insert my, what about January 1st, the birthday of Gustav Whitehead? But we won't go down that road.
Oh, you know, I have to admit that I went through my time hop today, and on August 19th, 3 years ago, I said to Max Flight on Twitter, how come there's no Gustav Whitehead Aviation Day? So I guess turnaround is fair play.
And so there are aviation events all over in celebration. A number of airports and other organizations, museums, a lot of folks have, airlines have put together different ways to celebrate. And as we talked about in the opening, Jennifer, you participated in something that Airline Geeks has been involved in for a couple of years, and that's I guess we call it Aviation Day. And you visited the Philadelphia airport to participate. So give us a little bit of a rundown on what that event was like.
Sure. So for anybody who's not familiar with it, American Airlines and Airline Geeks partner to offer these events. I believe it's at American's hubs. So Charlotte, Philly, Phoenix, LaGuardia, I believe, JFK. They also do an event at the Tulsa maintenance facility, and they also did one at London Heathrow this year. And you have to be somewhat lucky to snag a spot. And it's a very small group at each location. David, I don't know how many were in the group when you went through. There were only 8 of us this year at Philly. And I think there were maybe 12 of us in Charlotte last year when I did it.
I think when I did it, it may have been as much as 12.
Right.
I know that I was the odd man out because I sort of snuck in the back way. But I think we had about 12 people.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So there were 7 of us this year. And basically, it's an opportunity to take a look behind the scenes with American Airlines. We started in their corporate offices. We went from there to, is it called the Admiral's Lounge? Whatever their lounge is for their silver, gold customers. Then we went from there to the maintenance facility. We got to go on board an A330, and we got to take a closer look at the maintenance facility itself. We went over to the ground support equipment maintenance facility. I looked for stairs trucks. They wisely moved them away. We got to go into their cargo facility, which they have set up to be able to ship pharmaceuticals. And I gather it took quite a bit of doing to get this facility set up. It has a number of different storage rooms that all have to be maintained at very specific temperatures. And then when the pharmaceuticals are moved into containers to be loaded onto aircraft, those containers also have to be maintained at very specific temperatures. So there's a lot that they have to do in terms of monitoring and making sure the pharmaceuticals stay at the right temperatures. From there, we went over and looked at Terminal F, which I think is maybe one of the newer terminals in terms of having been renovated more recently. David, I don't know if you're familiar with that one?
Yes.
Okay.
You are correct.
Okay. And then from there, we went back to the office for lunch. And joining us for lunch was Olympia Colasanti, who is the vice president of, I believe, hub operations in Philadelphia for American Airlines. So getting to meet her and spend a good 40 minutes or so chatting with her was definitely really eye-opening, especially for me as someone who works in the industry at an airport. Sort of getting to get her take on things was interesting for sure.
And that's a lot of time for an executive like that. That for these kinds of events, sometimes you'll get sort of a flyby by one of the senior folks. But it sounds like you had a pretty lengthy conversation. That's great. I give American Airlines a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, agreed. I really got the sense that they enjoyed the opportunity to get in front of members of the public and let the members of the public, see what really goes on behind the scenes. And they really took advantage of this opportunity to introduce us to a number of different people who work behind the scenes for American Airlines. And just got the sense they really enjoyed the opportunity to sort of let us see what really goes on.
What were the other participants like? I mean, were they aviation enthusiasts like you, or people in the industry like you, or other people with a pathological attraction to airport, to stair trucks?
No, that's only me. They were not industry people. They were just people who are interested in aviation. Two of them are lawyers. There was another accountant. There were a couple who work in banking. So they were coming at it from, a variety of backgrounds. Now, one of the lawyers is currently working on his private pilot's license. And I talked to him a little bit afterwards, and he told me, he's actually seriously thinking about pursuing a career as a pilot. So for him, he got the opportunity to ask the chief pilot, who we also got to speak with, as well as Ms. Colasante, about the pilot shortage and to get their take on it. And they both were pretty consistent in saying that, yeah, there is a pilot shortage. Right now it's affecting the regionals, but a time is coming where it's going to affect the legacy carriers as well. And that if you've got a license or you're working on it and you're getting all your ratings, like, now is the time. So I think that was really encouraging for him.
And I know one lawyer who now flies for regional. I know two doctors that fly for regional. So, yeah, I mean, folks, you wouldn't traditionally think getting into becoming airline pilots are doing it. And you're right. It's the best time in history to do it.
Yeah, so some of the things that Ms. Colasanti talked about that I was really interested in were about airport expansion. So I mentioned that, and we can talk about statistics here in a little bit, but I mentioned that our terminal is older, and eventually we're going to have to do something about it, either completely renovating it, or do we build a new one? These are all things that are currently under discussion. Somebody asked Ms. Colasanti if she could change anything in the industry or at American Airlines, what would she change? Wasn't totally surprised to hear her say that she would like to see the air traffic control system become more modernized. To her credit, she did not use the word privatization.
Yeah.
I was waiting. She didn't go there, but she did talk about wanting to see the system more modernized and wanting to be able to have more planes in the air. So that naturally led to, what about on the ground then? If you're going to be having more planes in the air, they've got to land somewhere. Where are you going to fit them in at the airports? And she said that, airlines are really only interested in airport expansion if it's going to directly benefit them. Otherwise, it's an added cost. And they're really more interested in filling the seats that they currently have and running, as high a load factor as possible. So I thought that was interesting because it sort of opened my eyes to maybe some of the challenges that, airport planners and management face. This is another layer that they have to tackle in terms of what kind of expansion do we do and how do we get the airlines on board with it.
I don't know if Ms. Colasanti gave you any of her background, but do you know where she started in aviation?
Well, she's from Canada.
Yep.
And she actually told us that she started out in banking, but that she'd always been really interested in aviation. And an opportunity came up to apply to be, I think it was a gate agent, a part-time gate agent.
A ticket agent, yes.
Yeah. And so she decided to apply for it. And she said she really had to convince them to interview her and let her take the test because, you know, they're like, you want to go from banking to being a part-time ticket agent? Are you sure? And so she really had to kind of talk her way into it. She took the test and she said she showed up for, you know, the first day where everybody was getting matched with the person who was going to train them. And she watched as everybody else in her class got matched. And when they got to her, they said, yeah, we want you to come upstairs. So she thought, uh-oh, what's the deal here? And they took her upstairs and she got to meet with some people in management who told her, you know, you got 100% on this test. You know, what is it you really want to do with, you know, in terms of a career in aviation? And from there, they really sort of, she said they kind of took her in and trained her and gave her a lot of experience on the managerial side. And I guess she worked for several airlines in Canada. And then when US Airways began operating in Canada, she started working for them. And eventually they moved her here to the U.S. And then, of course, when U.S. Airways and American merged, she ended up at American.
Quite a story, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. And it's good to see women in these positions. You know, we hear a lot about how there aren't many women working in aviation. And I, you know, it's just nice to see strong female role models in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, one other story that I heard from some of the folks at American Airlines was about, you recall a few months ago, the incident with Southwest where they had an engine failure and a window blew out and a passenger was killed.
Yes.
And as you might recall, that plane diverted to Philadelphia. And American Airlines apparently took many of those Southwest passengers into their lounges where they could, you know, congregate together in a place that was comfortable and just, you know, sort of looked after them. And they said, you know, when something like that happens, we stop being competitors and instead become a big aviation family. Mm. And apparently Southwest sent all the employees cookies to thank them for their hospitality for their passengers.
What a great story. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was really nice.
Yes.
A positive news story about PHL. What a concept.
A positive airline story. Exactly.
It must be because I've moved away.
Yeah.
Could be. Something else I saw that sort of really caught my attention. And again, David, you might be able to speak to this a little bit. I don't know. But when we were heading through one of the concourses to get on the bus to go over to the maintenance facility, we went by one of the gates and there was a bar in the gate holding room. So passengers didn't have to, you know, duck down the hallway to go to the bar. There was a bar right there. And
well, that's convenient.
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. The folks from American Airlines were saying it was kind of a challenge because bars tend to be sort of noisy. And so when it's time to try to get passengers out of the bar and onto the airplane, sometimes that can be challenging for them.
Hmm.
And they said that the airport, apparently, what they told me was that the airport had given them a break on landing fees in exchange for being willing to have a bar in the gate area. The airport employee in me wonders if maybe it wasn't a break on landing fees, but perhaps either a break on the rent that they would have to pay for the gate areas, or perhaps some kind of arrangement where they get some kind of money back based on the concessions from those bar areas. I'm not entirely sure, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah,
But Atlanta's the same way. When I was stranded in Atlanta coming home from my trip down there, the bar literally was about 15 steps away from my gate.
Yeah.
You know, boy. And so it was, When I got on the airplane and I sat down and they said, PHL is under ground stop. Everybody off the airplane. I got off the airplane and went straight to the bar and had a drink until they told me to get back on the airplane because I was like, okay.
So that's something else I was wondering about is what happens when you have delays? I have to imagine that the whole room, I mean, it can get very chaotic at the gates anyway when you have delays and you've got flights overlapping and passengers overlapping. But add a bar into that, like right in the middle of it, I have to imagine that adds to the challenge from an operational standpoint.
No, everybody's much better after they've had an adult beverage. They socialize. They realize that, you know, it's just, it's okay, you know. It's just the way people are, and it's just, the only thing better maybe would be if you were in Colorado or California, where they might have a dispensary now located near the gates.
Well, from a practical standpoint, once you have these inebriated people onto the airplane and they're now flying at 37,000 feet and a cabin altitude of over 6,000 feet, you know, that usually exacerbates the effect of alcohol. So they may be, you know, perfectly manageable on the ground, but now you throw them up at altitude and they're going to change and some of them are going to be unruly. I think.
Did you just say they were going to throw up at altitude? Yeah.
I'm not sure I said that, but I kind of wonder, you know, maybe instead of a reduction in rent at the gate, they were given a cut of the revenue from the bar, which kind of leads me to worry, you know, is this what we're going to see in the future? Airlines are going to now start making money off out of their gate areas by putting in slot machines and bars and, you know, whatever else they can.
Yeah, to be fair, you know, I don't really know the ins and outs of, you know, what the details are behind the arrangement. But I happened to notice the bar right there and some of the employees from American Airlines who were taking us around, you know, talked about it. I gathered it was something new in Philadelphia or relatively new. And it's been a little bit of a challenge for them operationally, it sounds like.
All right. Well, it sounds like the event, Jennifer, was a big success. So this sounds like something that you would recommend other people try to get a spot for next time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they do slightly different things at each location. I know last year at Charlotte, we got to visit one of their training centers. I don't think they have a pilot training facility at Philadelphia, but they do at Charlotte. So getting to go in there and see the simulators and some of the equipment that they have there and learn a little bit more about it was really interesting as well. So I don't know. I'm thinking maybe I'll try to go to O'Hare next year. Check that place out.
Yeah, you could become the first person to visit all of the airports on this weekend each year.
Well, I'm working on it. Again, as an aviation enthusiast, it's a once in a lifetime or, you know, an occasional opportunity to get behind the scenes that you're not really going to get ordinarily. And as an airport employee, I really do learn a lot also. So for me, I get sort of a double benefit out of the experience.
Sure, sure. Tell us about your job. How is your job going? Anything new happening since last time we spoke with you?
Yeah, job is going good. It's busy. You know, the last time I was on, I think was, what, June of 2016. So I thought it would be interesting to compare some statistics from June of 2016 to this past June of 2018. Our enplaned passengers, so that's passengers getting onto an airplane, is up 9.6%. Our total passengers are up 9%. So as you can see, our passenger numbers are growing. And in fact, we are going to be super close to maybe hitting 8 million passengers this year, which would be an all-time high if we get there. I also took a look at cargo. Now, I work for an airport authority, and we actually run more than one airport. And we do have another airport that is, they call it cargo dedicated. We really do have some passenger service there, but it is primarily cargo. And June 2016 to June 2018, the amount of cargo is up 44.7%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That airport is growing like crazy.
Wow. In 2 years, that's what it was up?
Yeah, just comparing June 2016 to June 2018, up 44.7%. Yeah.
Well, that's phenomenal. Did you bring in a new carrier, or it seems like something must have changed other than just normal growth?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Several new carriers, in fact. I really have to give a lot of credit to the people who worked together to really establish the cargo airport as a cargo airport. You know, you can't just go, well, we have this airport over here. Let's make it cargo. Yeah, bring us your cargo. It doesn't work that way. And when they took a look at it and decided that they really wanted to boost cargo operations, they went about it in a really, I think they did a lot of really smart things. So, for example, they improved the infrastructure. They put in the roads that you're going to need to support trucks that are going to be needed to take the cargo to and from the airport. They also put in an intermodal rail facility. So you have trains coming and going. I forget how many lifts per day the intermodal facility is doing, but it's also extremely busy. And then they worked with freight forwarding companies, because that's really who you have to connect with to bring in cargo. And it wasn't just an airport effort, you know, it was also a city effort. And some other organizations and groups really got on board, including some local businesses. So, yes, we've increased the number of international flights coming in quite a bit. We've got, Cathay Pacific, Cargolux, Emirates, Etihad, China Airlines, Airbridge Cargo. And I might be forgetting one or two who are doing regular flights in. And then we also get Antonov will come in. We'll get Atlas in. And then we have FedEx and UPS, which both operate out of there as well.
So, yeah, I'm just thinking, when you bring in an international carrier, you know, Cathay Pacific and so on, are they then transferring all those packages to local trucks or to FedEx, which then takes it down to Memphis? Or what happens with all the international cargo?
I think a lot of that international cargo is going onto trucks and going out locally. Mm-hmm. One of the nice things about the part of the Midwest where we're located is that we are within a day's drive of a very large portion of the United States. So one of the big selling points for our cargo airport versus other cargo airports is, a plane lands at, say, O'Hare, and the cargo is offloaded. It takes 24 hours before that cargo actually gets onto a truck and gets on the road. But with our airport, you know, you're talking 3 or 4 hours, which is a huge difference.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can do, what you can accomplish if you focus on an objective and build the infrastructure to support it. And it sounds like it's been a big success from the cargo standpoint.
Yeah, it really has. And the passenger airline that operates, we have a low-cost carrier operating out of that airport, and they're growing as well. I don't remember the exact numbers, so I hesitate to quote them, but they were double-digit growth there as well. Not as big as the cargo, but still increasing. So one of the other things that I ended up taking on recently is the FBO billing for the cargo airport. Now, most airports, the FBOs are independently owned and operated. But at our cargo airport, the airport authority actually owns the FBO, and we operate it. And we therefore do a lot of the billing, or I guess to be more specific, I do a lot of the billing. Now, for general aviation, if you're just flying in, parking, getting some gas, that's all handled by credit card transaction. My billing really focuses on these bigger airlines where I'm not just doing landing fees, but I'm also handling the turn fees, the de-icing fees, overtime fees for the ground handling personnel if a flight's delayed and we have to keep them there, that kind of thing. So it's been pretty eye-opening for me to sort of delve into some of that.
You've got me very excited. Tell me you also have the avgas concession or the jet fuel concession there, because if you know, cargo is up 44%, the fuel flow must be up tremendously.
Yeah, we do the fueling also. Exactly.
Oh. Yeah, that's got to be big bucks. I would imagine that's that really has helped the budget a lot.
Yeah, I would say that it has. Now, I don't have the fuel numbers in front of me, but it definitely all feeds together. If you've got more flights coming in, that's more landing fees, that's more cargo, that's more turn fees, that's more de-icing fluid if the weather's bad.
Now, you got me on one there, turn fees. What are those? I don't know what that is.
So turn fees are the act of unloading an airplane and then reloading it with the cargo that's going out and doing the servicing, so cleaning or whatever else needs to happen with that airplane. As you know, we divide airlines into two categories. You have signatory, and those are airlines that have an agreement with the airport, and then non-signatory, and those are airlines that do not have an agreement and just come in periodically. And so if that would be
the AN-124 that you were chasing after that couldn't be billed.
That would be the AN-124 that I got to get up close and personal with not too long ago. For example, a full turn fee for a signatory airline is $3,200. And that is for, we break it out based on pallets. So the $3,200 is if you have over 35 pallets. It's less if there are fewer pallets. And then we also have a half turn fee if you were just unloading your plane but not loading anything onto it.
I see. So you actually provide all the personnel and the forklifts and all that stuff.
Indeed, we do.
I see.
Jennifer, you keep mentioning de-icing. Now, have you really been hanging out on the de-icing pad?
Yeah, at the passenger airport, I have. How crazy is that?
That is crazy. Now, when I was working at Pratt, I mean, I worked with a lot of people in the finance department, and I certainly wouldn't have wanted any of them out there working with a de-icing machine, probably working with any kind of equipment out there. But
how did you
get involved in this?
Well, so to back up a little bit, I guess they start right around now. The airport airfield maintenance department puts together what they call their snow surge team. These are employees at the airport, not airfield employees, but other employees, custodial, human resources, accounting, IT, wherever you might happen to be, who are interested in getting trained on snow plows, brooms, trucks. And they put together this surge team who basically backs up the regular airfield crews. So they get trained on how to use the equipment. And if we ever get a major snow event, they can activate the surge team to help out. The most of the runway clearing and everything is handled by the regular airfield personnel. But they have this backup crew of airport employees who can come out and assist with clearing taxiways and ramp areas and things like that. So a couple of years ago, they were recruiting for people to be on the surge team and, you know, a chance to drive big plows around. Like, okay, I'm interested in that. Yeah. So they might take out some signs and lights and cars.
This is a young lady who drives an MG convertible.
Which is very, very small. But at any rate, so I was interested in it, but the amount of time that you have to commit to training and the kind of availability that you have to have just wasn't going to work with my schedule. Snow season is sort of coincidentally a very busy time in accounting as well, because you're closing out one year and getting another year started. So, I thought about doing the surge team, but realized it wasn't necessarily going to be a good fit for me. But then I got pulled into my manager's office and she said, listen, operations heard that you were interested in doing the surge team and wanted to give you another opportunity to perhaps help out managing the de-ice pad. Are you interested? And it took me all of, you know, maybe 2 seconds to say, yeah, of course I'm interested. And so I got a chance to meet with the operations manager to find out what it was all about. And I thought, yeah, I want to learn more. So I spent the winter of 2016, 2017 out on the de-ice pad learning the art of de-ice pad management. So it's not being in the sprayer spraying. That's not it. It's managing the flow of traffic into and out of the de-ice pad.
Ah, so the planes go to the de-ice pad to get de-iced, right?
Right.
Because the de-icing fluid needs to be collected and treated properly.
We actually do have the capability of de-icing at the gates. You're right. The fluid does have to be collected and treated, but we do have the ability to do that at the gates. However, most of the airlines prefer to go to the de-ice pad. Because we're not a huge airport, we don't have ramp control. Normally, the ramp is uncontrolled, and so is the de-ice pad. But at certain times of the day, in particular early morning, you have a lot of flights that are all pushing at the same time, all trying to get onto the de-ice pad at the same time. And the airport found over time that if you don't put a plan in place to manage the flow of traffic, it can become a real mess. So basically, managing the de-ice pad involves being in a truck, talking on the radio to airplanes, giving them taxi instructions, positioning them on the de-ice pad, and then clearing them once the de-icing is complete and turning them over to ATC ground.
Hmm. How about sequencing the planes? Is that part of it?
Well, you're sequencing them onto the de-ice pad.
But I mean, is there an order that you would place them in, or is just kind of first come, first served?
It's pretty much first come, first served, but you do have to be cognizant of who you've got on the de-ice pad, what lines you have available on the de-ice pad. Some of the lines are designed for smaller airplanes, so you're not going to be able to put, you know, necessarily an A320 on those lines. So if those lines are available and you're getting a call from an A320, they're going to have to wait where you could put an ERJ or a CRJ on those lines. But yeah, so it's, and at the same time that you're driving around in a truck and talking on the radio, you're also logging all of the planes, each plane that you put into the pad, how long they're on there. You have to get their flight number, what type they are, and so on. So it was quite an adventure.
That's all so she could bill them later.
Of course.
Yeah, well, at the passenger airport, we don't bill them for the de-icing or anything. That's all handled separately. So two of the big carriers have their own crews and their own de-icing fluid, and the others use the FBO.
Oh, I see. Are there passengers on the plane when they're being de-iced?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're ready to go, essentially, right?
Exactly. They're just getting... Most of the time, what we're doing in the mornings is just knocking the frost off. You can't have any contaminant on the planes before they take off. So they'll come to get the frost knocked off the wings and the tail. But in the case of a snow event, you know, then it gets even more crazy because it takes longer to get them through the de-icing process because you're not just knocking the frost off, but you're also putting type 4 anti-ice onto the plane so that they don't collect more snow on their way out to the runway to take off. So it takes longer and the whole process gets a little more complicated. At the same time, you have maintenance planes that are being taxied across the de-ice pad to get to gates. So you have to manage them as well. So it can be quite a challenge. I call it Tetris with airplanes. And I have to give a shout out to Chris. He is the operations supervisor. He's one of the people who was training me, and he listens to the show. So I know he's going to be listening to this and shaking his head. Probably.
Hey, Chris. Oh, cool.
Yeah, I've got to say, you make de-icing sound more interesting and exciting than I could ever have imagined. I'm just sitting here going, yeah, tell me more. I want to go do this. And you know, it's great. You just bring such tremendous enthusiasm to, you know, areas of airport management that most of us just never think about.
Yeah, well, it gets pretty intense out there. And yes, I've driven a truck around on the ramp, and Chris was my trainer while I was driving the truck, so he can attest to the fact that I managed not to run into anything I shouldn't run into. I didn't end up out on any taxiways or runways. And I've also, you know, I've worked on the radio, talked to airplanes on the radio and all of that. So I don't know, who'd have thought, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they haven't banned you from the de-ice pad, so.
They haven't.
No. Nope. No.
And I'm, you know, I wasn't able to participate last year because there were some changes in the accounting department. And we were all having to do a little bit extra and cover some extra to stay on top of things. And I just did not have the extra time to be able to help out on the de-ice pad. And I was really pretty sad about it, honestly. So we'll see. Maybe I'll be able to get back out there this year.
Yeah, you're probably just waiting for winter to come, right? I mean, I would be.
No, I'm not really a big fan of winter. But that's one of the, you know, one of the things that makes winter more interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Let's just jump to the topic of airport outreach, and this is something that I think is very important. Different airports are, well, I think there's a varying degree of skills that they possess to do this. Tell us a little bit about what's happening at your airport.
Yeah, you know, if I had to pick a platform, you know, of a cause that I would, you know, espouse, I would say our airport outreach would be, you know, right up there is one of the things I'm really passionate about. Just airports and communities that surround them really need to find ways to connect to each other. And there's a number of different ways that this can be done. Some things that that my airport has been doing, we had our first runway 5K last year. We're going to be having another one this year. And that's a really great opportunity for people who, you know, maybe they never have had cause to travel through the airport as a passenger, but they get to come and experience it by running up and down the runway. And I have to give kudos to the team who put the 5K together because they really took advantage of having so many people right there on the airfield by bringing out a lot of the airfield equipment. They had all kinds of informational signs up that it said, you know, this is what this piece of equipment does, and this is how many, you know, this is how much snow we can move with this plow, and this is how many passengers we saw last year. Just really help the general public get a better idea of exactly what we do and how we do it. So that's one thing.
And I just got to ask, did you guys steal that idea from somewhere? Because I've never heard of that before, and it's just a phenomenally great idea.
Well, no, they do it. A lot of airports do it. O'Hare does it every year. Wow. But many airports are doing it now. And I believe JFK also. It's just a great opportunity. It does take some coordination. You have to coordinate with the FAA. But it's well worth doing. And we did it as a fundraiser for Honor Flight, which is, you know, a fantastic organization to be able to support. Something else that we did recently was we took some Instagrammers that do a lot of aviation pictures in the area and invited them to come behind the scenes and get a little tour. And I thought that was a really great idea. These are people who are already excited about aviation, excited about the airport, and are posting pictures. And it sort of you know, builds more connections with them that way. And one other thing that we do every year is what's called the ACE Academy. And basically, the ACE Academy is essentially a week-long aviation day camp for minority youth ages 12 to 15. And it's an event that we host in conjunction with the Organization of Black Aerospace Professionals. And I got to tell you, I am so jealous of these kids because They got to spend a day just going all behind the scenes at the passenger airport. They spent another day going all behind the scenes at the cargo airport, including going up in the ATC tower and touring the FBO. They got to spend the day at our general aviation airport. And we have, there's a community college that has an A&P mechanics program at that airport. So they got to go visit the college. They also got to go to a nearby Air Force base and go on a tour there. And then they also got to spend some time at another nearby general aviation airport, finding out about the flight school that's there and going on airplane rides. So does that sound awesome or what?
That is so good.
If only every airport did all those things. That's great.
Yeah, it's truly, it's great. I'm really excited and pleased to be part of a group that does make the effort to sort of reach out and connect with the community. It's important.
Yeah, you mentioned the Organization of Black Aerospace Professionals. They're at obap.org. I think maybe we should reach out to them and see if we can get someone from that organization to come on the show as a guest and learn more about what they do. It's a fascinating organization.
Absolutely.
Yeah. An airport has to be part of the community. I mean, it is in the community. It's in some kind of a community. And just to be passive and just exist apart from the community probably is not the best long-term strategy. So it's great to hear that you guys are doing things like this to include the community.
And I have to tell you really quickly, the general aviation airport that has the flight school, that airport is really sandwiched in the midst of a bunch of neighborhoods. And there was some concern at some point that the airport may be, you know, closed or made smaller. And that airport has really gone all out in terms of the way they connect with the community. They do a bunch of things. But one thing that I really love is when they built a new ATC tower, they left the old ATC tower and they made it really kid friendly.
They
put kid tables, kid chairs, coloring books, you name it. And I know so many parents who love taking their children there. Now, you want support for an airport, get the parents on board. If you connect with the parents, you're good because they are really passionate about organizations where they and, you know, activities where they can take their kids. And they spread the word amongst other parents and are really protective of places like that. So I thought that was really brilliant.
Oh, man, I'd like to meet the person that thought of that idea. Just really something spectacular.
Well, if I can figure out who it was, I'll let you know.
Yeah, do that. Do that.
I was thinking we've left some of our audience in the dark here a little bit. We've made two references here to Jennifer's affinity to Stairs Truck. So I think that we should pull the curtain aside for those who aren't familiar. And Max, I don't know if you noticed, but on her webpage currently on her blog, there's a picture of her with a Stairs Truck. So Jennifer, why don't you take it away? Tell us about you and Stairs Truck so people are not left in mystery here.
You mean in terms of what a Stairs Truck is or why I'm so fond of them?
Well, both if you'd like.
Both? Well, a Stairs Truck, for anybody who maybe has never seen one, is a truck with stairs on the back. And in places where you do not have a gate to pull up to for passengers to get on and off of an airplane, you can pull this truck up to the airplane and the passengers can climb up the stairs and get on that way, or the pilots or the flight crew, whoever needs to get on and off of the airplane. So that's what the Stairs Truck is. Now, I like it because it's just the coolest piece of ground equipment. I mean, I don't know what more you need to say. You get on and off of airplanes with it.
It's so specialized.
It
I mean, that's
is.
It, right?
Yeah, and I've given a lot of thought to things. You could take it to a concert and have the best seat, you know, especially if you're going to one of those outdoor general admission concerts. You just climb up there on the top step and you're going to be way above everybody else. You can paint your house. You can have a fantastic time picking apples. Like, trust me, I have given this a lot of thought.
David, we should rent a stair truck someday and take one to an air show. Then we can stand up there on the top and get some great photos.
Yeah, just don't fall off, please.
Yeah, they, and heaven forbid you point out a non-stairs truck and accuse it of being a stairs truck?
Right. Well, there's different levels. You have mobile stairs. So those are just stairs on wheels and they can be pushed or tugged into position. And then you have motorized stairs. So those are stairs that have like a golf cart front to them. And then you have the actual trucks.
And I presume the truck is what you really love, right?
That's my favorite, but I'm, you know, mobile stairs are all pretty cool in their own way.
So I'm guessing that, you've seen Top Gear and this is a key part of your love for stairs trucks.
Yeah. The airport vehicle race. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Anybody who hasn't seen it needs to go to YouTube and look it up immediately.
There's nothing better than racing a stairs truck around a closed track.
Yeah. Against a fuel truck and a fire tug truck. And a fire truck and a catering vehicle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm with you. I want to be in the stairs truck every time.
Exactly.
So Aero Specialties has a listing for a Stinnar SPS 3518 passenger stair truck, 96 to 228 inches. It's based on a 2017 Ford F-350 chassis. It's got a 6.2-liter Triton V8 gasoline engine with a block heater. Platform load capacity, 1,000 pounds. Boy, you know, it says this item will be quoted. So maybe I'll submit a quote to this, Jennifer, and see if we can...
Well, I can tell you, actually, because we just bought a new one for the cargo airport. So the passenger airport, the business of getting passengers on and off the planes is the responsibility pretty much of the airlines. And we have lots of gates, so the authority doesn't need stairs trucks at the passenger airport. But at the cargo airport, we do have stairs trucks. And I want to say that the new one was roughly $88,000.
Hmm. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a price new?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I better switch over to the used market, maybe.
Yeah. But what if you were to rent one for a day? I mean, could we go to like Hertz or Avis? And surely they must have one of those as the premium rents.
I think the sad part about stairs trucks is that they're not certified for use on the road.
Oh. Hmm.
Yeah. I don't think they have all of the safety, airbags and everything else that are required of passenger vehicles.
No, you got to look closely at that picture on your blog. Right next to your right elbow is a license plate. So I think that one is certified for the road.
Maybe.
You'd also have to be careful about the bridges you drove under.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a riot. Well, I guess, so they actually tilt down, don't they? I mean, there must be a stowed position.
Yes, they raise up and lower.
All right. Well, Jennifer, we've covered a lot of territory, and it's all been fascinating. We really have enjoyed having you come back on the show. And tell our audience where they can find you online.
You can find my blog at talesfromtheterminal.com. And I write just pieces about... sometimes about the airport, but just sometimes about other things that I'm involved in aviation. Yeah, you can find me on Instagram. It's at Tales from the Terminal. And if you want to find me on Twitter, it's Jen_Niffer.
I always thought that was incredibly clever.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
We have just a little bit of time left. Max Trescott, something going on in your world aviation-wise?
Ooh, well, I can tell you that I had I had a situation on Friday where I thought I was going to watch an accident occur. I was really just sweating bullets watching a pilot. I was in the run-up area on Friday morning for runway 31 at Palo Alto and had our heads down kind of doing stuff in the cockpit when suddenly we saw an aircraft fly low in front of us from left to right. And my first thought was, oh, I guess they've changed the runways. This guy must have taken off from runway 13. And as I continued to watch him go to my right, I realized he had one notch of flaps in. It was a Cessna. and he was not climbing much at all. So he made it up to maybe about 100 feet or so. And I just thought, oh my gosh, this guy's got engine trouble. I am going to watch an accident right here in front of me. And I did not want to see that, but we continued to watch. And then he started to make a large circle to come back to runway 31. We happened to have the tower tuned up, and the tower controller said, and taxiway Zulu is also available. And I thought, great, that's right where we're parked, essentially. So I was kind of hoping that if he aimed for the taxiway, he would make it over us before he got to that taxiway. But he did gain a little bit of altitude as he turned back to the runway. Was probably ever so slightly high as he crossed the threshold. Then I noticed that he had removed all the flaps, so he had forgot to put those back in for landing, so he used the entire runway to land and ended up going off the edge of the runway with no injuries. And I don't know if there was any damage to the aircraft. I'm guessing there probably wasn't. We then watched all kinds of police cars, you know, stream down the runway right in front of us because the entry point was right where we were sitting. It was amazing how fast a police car can go down a runway. Those things. The first vehicle out there was an airport truck. And sometime later, the first police car arrived, and he just about caught up with the truck by the end of the runway, which was pretty pretty amazing. But the tower said that fire equipment was rolling, and were there any injuries? And they must have sent those back because they didn't actually show up. And we finally just taxi backed and terminated the lesson because it was clear the runway is going to be closed for a while. All I can say is I have been at the scene of accidents before, shortly after they've happened, and it's pretty unpleasant when there's loss of life. And I was just hoping that I was not going to see that happen in front of me. So I was really, really thrilled that it didn't. So apparently this pilot took off from runway 31, had low engine output, and decided to make a turn back to the runway, and for whatever reason wasn't successful in his first pass, which is when we saw him, which is interesting because I had just talked about what the FAA calls the impossible turn, which is turning back to the runway when you have either an engine failure or poor running engine. So he did not follow the standard guidance, which would be to kind of land straight ahead in the marsh, but decided to instead bet that the engine was going to continue to keep making, what power it was making until he made it back to the runway. I mean, that's the problem when you have an engine problem. You may have some power left, but there's no guarantee that you're going to continue to have that power as you, try and get back to the runway. So anyway, this pilot, I think, was very lucky that the engine problem didn't get worse and, that he managed his turns twice back to the runway safely.
Well, there was another recent episode on the runway. This was sent to us by our listener, Curtis, and he sent a link to a YouTube video, Plane Narrowly Misses Collision with Van. And this happened at the Springfield Branson Airport. I guess that's in Missouri, is this, I think?
It is. I was at that airport about 6 months ago when I stopped to bring an aircraft across the country. So, yeah, I know it well.
Wow. Well, apparently there was some kind of a cookout or barbecue or something, and folks in this van were headed to wherever that was going to be. And they say that they were cleared to cross a runway, but also on that runway was an E-170 coming down. And there really was not a lot of space between the two of them when they intersected. It's kind of dramatic. The NTSB is investigating this. This was a close call, but it would seem that something broke down. Some part of the process broke down in terms of keeping a separation here. But thanks to Curtis for sending that along. We'll put that video right in the show notes.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I've been to airport barbecues. They are pretty tasty.
You can understand the motivation to get there.
But I don't think I would want to go zipping across a runway necessarily to get to one. Although, from what I understand, they believed they were cleared to cross the runway, but maybe didn't take a look to confirm that. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, the employee statement has said that they were cleared across the runway, but didn't necessarily look as they crossed it. And I just kind of looked at the time counter at the bottom of the video. By the time the car crossed, I would say it was no more than 2 to 3 seconds before the jet went through that same intersection.
Hmm. Well, thankfully there wasn't a collision, because that would have been very tragic, I think. One other item, and this came in from Will. This is pretty interesting. So when we were talking about the Q400 last time that had been stolen and subsequently crashed with the guy flying it killing himself, Will had some information about this. He said years ago I worked as an airline ramp agent, although not Horizon, and am a former Dash 8 pilot on the smaller, he says, Dash 100, Dash 300 variants. But he said, some comments were made to suggest ramp agents normally know how to start the aircraft and reposition it. He says this is not correct. Maintenance personnel taxi the aircraft from the gate to the hangar and back. A ramp agent is responsible for loading and unloading bags and driving the tug to push the aircraft back to the gate. The only reason he says a ramp agent would have to stick his head in the cockpit is to give the loading manifest to the flight crew. He says at many airlines, even that is transmitted electronically, so there's no reason for a ramp agent to be in the cockpit. And he says, I hope that clears things up. So thanks, Will, for that information. Could also mention, I noticed our recent guest, John Ostrower. We talked about him starting up the Air Current, and he has an article in that is an open article. In other words, you don't have to be a subscriber to read this article, and it's titled Asking the Right Questions After a Q400 is Stolen. And John talks about the trust system that exists in aviation and how that relates to this. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Invite you to take a look at that. It's a nice little piece. John's done a good job here. And while we're at it, remember that you can get a discount on a subscription to John Ostrower's The Air Current if you use the coupon code or the discount code AirplaneGeeks. It's all one word. When you subscribe, and the link to subscribe to that is, cleverly enough, is subscribe.theaircurrent.com. So, and again, we thank John for offering a discount for Airplane Geeks listeners. Okay, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. And again, our guest was Jennifer Adams. Jennifer, we had a fantastic conversation with you. Really appreciate it. Tell us again really quickly where folks can find you online.
Sure. It's talesfromtheterminal.com. You can find me on Instagram at talesfromtheterminal and on Twitter at Jen_Niffer. And thank you very much for having me on. It was fun.
We had a blast, too. You can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Visit airplanegeeks.com to find show notes for all the episodes. But if you'd like to go straight to the show notes for this episode, they will be at airplanegeeks.com/517, the episode number. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Max Trescott, let's start with you.
Well, first, I want to let everyone know about the new Kickstarter program that I've just started here, and I want to encourage people to donate. You can find it at buyjenastairstruck.com.
Yeah.
And so, about the first $80,000, and if you donate $5,000, you will get a free ride down the runway at her airport in the stairs truck.
I don't know about that.
Well, we'll work out the details later. But just the broad plan is being put together here. But unless you find me standing by the runway at Palo Alto Airport, you can find me online at aviationnewstalk.com. Just click on contact and also take a listen to the podcast.
David Vanderhoof, you're up.
Well, first, you can find me on our Slack listener team. We want you to join our exclusive club, so you can send us a request to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you a personal invite so you can knock on the door and join the conversation with a bunch of our intense listeners. And, of course, you can find me on Fridays with that guy, Max Flight, talking drones on theuavdigest.com. And if you can spell DM Vanderhoof, you can find me on Twitter, stalking Jen Niffer on Twitter.
Thanks, David. And you can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me in LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, and with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You know where to find him. That's BrunoMassone.com, BrunoMissonne, BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, darn no.
It. If only the rest of the crowd were here.
Yeah.
It just seemed like the perfect follow-up to our horse and cow discussion.
Okay. I don't know.
Do we even want to know what that was?
Jennifer, it's Max here. The joke is that over the last day or two, the host and previous host have been exchanging silly emails about horses and cows, all because of the Southwest announcement that they're allowing miniature horses on the car, onto the airplane. So I joined the call with a mooing sound.
Right.
And I just thought that was appropriate to, you know, just kind of bring that back up to here again. So.
Well, neighing might be more appropriate.
That's the way I feel about Skype today.
You sort of started this, Trescott. You said
I did, absolutely.
It'd be simpler if it were a cow. Then it could ride in steerage.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'll be here all week.
Nice pun.
Then Rob says, yeah, but if you start putting cows in steerage, where will the rest of us ride?
Oh, good point.
And then, then Trescott goes, yeah. He says, again, with cows, it's much easier. You just tell them to move over.
Then I found that... That funny little cartoon, and I said cows are really cool, and it showed a picture of a cow standing next to a wind turbine, and it said something about, how is it that we, California
governments can afford to cool down cows with fans.
Turn the fans on to cool cows. Yeah. Then, I like that. That was great.
Then Brian says, this whole conversation is utterly ridiculous. I can't believe you let this go to the dogs like that. Then he says, what will you other cats have to say about this? Or what did you other cats have to say about this?
So, Jen, hopefully you still want to be on the show.
I don't know. That's almost too many puns.
Yeah,
exactly. For my Monday, my brain's going to explode.
Well, it was not our typical intro show discussion, but it was fun.
No.
Actually, I'm impressed. Those were good. You're here all week, right? Tip my waitress and all that.
Exactly. Yeah, totally.
Did you see the one my wife came up with?
Yeah, I saw it.
She said, I don't see what the big problem is. You just have to vet the animals.
Oh, that was good. Yeah. What do you mean, Jen? We can't drive this thing down the runway? We could do it during the 5K, right? It'll be closed off then.
They can run up the stairs and jump off. It's an obstacle course.
They can ride on the back. Get a really great time in that 5K. I just don't, I don't have my driving privileges yet. So let me get those. Then we can talk about cruising up and down runways.